Live on tape from the Pioneer 90.1 FM KSRQ studios at the Center for New Media at Northland College in Thief River Falls and streaming worldwide at RadioNorthland.org, it's the independent pro wrestling in Minnesota show. With your host, hailing from somewhere in the extreme northwestern corner of Minnesota, Glenn Broggett.
Hello and welcome once again to Independent Pro Wrestling in Minnesota. I'm your host, Glenn Broggett. On today's edition, we are going to look back and discuss the history of professional wrestling in Minnesota with our very special guest. He's a diehard pro wrestling fan who had written for major wrestling publications. He's been a wrestling announcer. He's got a great memorabilia collection, like I said, and he's hosted some online wrestling talk shows too. And in 2010... he put out a fantastic book on the history of pro wrestling in this great state of Minnesota called Minnesota's Golden Age of Wrestling, from Vern Gagne to the Road Warriors. An excellent read. I've read it a couple of times over since it's come out, and it brings me great pleasure and a great honor to welcome the one and only Mr. George Shire to our program today. Thank you for coming on the show and making some time out of your still busy schedule.
Wow, Glenn. You know, in the wrestling business, they would call putting me over. That's what you just did, and that's great. I appreciate that very much.
And let me tell you something, man. I really appreciate this book that you put out last year. I saw it. I was down in the Twin Cities for a Twins weekend. It was around my birthday, and I saw it in one of the Barnes & Nobles down there, and I had to get it. And let me tell you something. I had that thing half read by the time I got back up here from Minneapolis to Thief River Falls.
Well, you were saying stuff that so many people have said to me over the last year, and, you know, I have to tell you a funny story. When I first was approached by the Minnesota Historical Society here in St. Paul to publish a book on Minnesota wrestling, they had known of my background and following it and everything, and they asked me a question. They said, would there be an interest in this? Are there going to be people that are going to buy this book? And I think any publisher would ask that question.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I proceeded to tell them, as I said, you know, you're going to be surprised because everyone back in the day watched All-Star Wrestling. And every territory around the country, and we'll get into that maybe as we talk, but wrestling was so popular, and everyone watched it, even those that wouldn't admit it at the time. When you talk about it today, they've got a story about the Crusher or Mad Dog Vachon, or they remember somebody, you know, some match they went to. And mm-hmm. The History Center was so surprised when every time they brought it up, that was the story. Everyone loved wrestling.
Absolutely, and I've got some pro wrestling stories, too, just growing up. My first taste of professional wrestling was watching the American Wrestling Association, Vern's League, the AWA, and I remember watching it with my parents and with my grandmother, who always claimed whenever it turned, she walked in and saw wrestling was on, she's like, oh, I don't like that stuff, but it'd be 10 minutes, 15 minutes, she'd still be watching it and getting into it just as much as I was getting into it, my brothers and sisters were getting into it, and my parents were getting into it. And then she ended up telling me about stories like when she lived out in California, out in the Bay Area, of watching some of the great wrestling out there, too. So it was one of those things where she was hesitant, but once she started watching, she was kind of like got the all clear, and she was ready to open up. And it was some great moments and great stories that she had to tell. And there's a lot of people up in this state of Minnesota, all over the country, that have great stories from, you know, generational stories of professional wrestling and their connection to it via the great televised AWA shows.
Well, one of the things that was really different back in the day, and if you'll notice the title of my book, the subtitle is From Vern Gagne to the Road Warriors, and that was definitely done on purpose. We ended it with the Road Warriors in 1990, because by that time, Glenn, that's when wrestling had really started to change. It had started to change in the mid-80s to more and more of what we see today when you turn on Monday Night Raw.
Mm-hmm.
The wrestling is very different today from the product that it was in the 80s, the 70s, the 60s, the 50s, and even back in the 40s. And that's what I wanted to cover in the book and give a history. And Minnesota is so rich in wrestling history, and having Vern Gagne, a great amateur wrestler, who had that background that he brought to pro wrestling. When you add the color to it and the characters and different things, Vern was the catalyst that made Minnesota wrestling as popular as it was.
Mm-hmm. And if there wasn't no Vern Gagne, I think that pro wrestling in the state of Minnesota, this is my opinion, and probably a few others share this, I don't think wrestling would have been able to get to the enormous heights that it did, because Vern brought so much to the table. He was athletic. He had from a collegiate background, did the Olympics thing. He was an all-American type of guy, and he had a great drawing power because he was just someone that people wanted to watch and people wanted to emulate.
Well, you know, one of the things that, you know, there's that old saying that sometimes it pays to be in the right place at the right time. And even though Vern was as great as he was with his amateur wrestling background, and for those fans that don't know, he represented the United States in the 1948 Olympics. And then he turned pro in 1949. But with Vern Gagne, he was in the right place at the right time, because around the end of the 40s, that's when television was first coming into its own.
Absolutely.
And, you know, if fans that are older, they'll realize and remember that not everyone had a TV. Not everyone could even afford a TV back in those days. So what happened was, is a lot of people would come around to the neighbor's house that had the television set on the night wrestling was on. And television stations realized real quick that wrestling was real cheap to produce, because they didn't have to put, you know, any real money into it. Just put up a ring in a studio and have some wrestlers come on board and get an advertiser, and boom, you had a show. And people loved it.
Mm-hmm. And absolutely.
And during that time, too, people used to, there were stores in the downtown areas that would actually put a television set in their display window and have wrestling on Tuesday nights or Saturday nights or whatever night it was. And Vern Gagne was one of those stars that was really big for TV, because he had that scientific amateur background. And then you started to get some characters, and I talk about that too in the book, about Gorgeous George.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a guy that started it all on the heel side that changed what a villain was, what a heel was in wrestling.
Mm-hmm. He brought in that feminine quality to it, but yet, you know, he backed it up with his wrestling, and I think that's what really got him, you know, the ire of these people. It's that cold term, love to hate.
Oh, exactly. And, you know, when you bring about the comment about being the feminine angle, here you have a guy who is about 5'9". He's an average-looking guy with brown hair. Basically, he's wrestled for a few years, not really setting any fires anywhere. He bleaches his hair blonde, gets a permanent after he grows it out, and he buys and has his wife make outlandish robes, calls himself Gorgeous George. And by the way, he had his name legally changed after a few years of wrestling as Gorgeous George. He had it legally changed to Gorgeous George. And he'd throw these gold bobby pins to the fans. And he was the very first wrestler, believe it or not, way back in the late 40s, very early 50s, that came to the ring with ring music. Now, everybody has ring music, but he was the first one. He came out to Pomp and Circumstance. And then he would take his time folding his robe. He'd have his valet or his wife, who often worked as his valet, spray the ring so there were no germs on it. He wouldn't let the referee touch him. He'd irritate the fans so much. And he made tons of money. It wasn't that he was the greatest wrestler, but he was a heck of a showman.
Mm-hmm. And that that basically kickstarted the trend of a lot of having the gimmicks and the imagery. And I mean, he wasn't the Vern Gagne, but he brought in a thing that kind of got the ball rolling. And there's so many great things we could talk about gimmick wise. But I want to talk about, what has the reaction been like for you for the book since you released it back in 2010?
Well, you know, and it's actually funny that you say 2010, because I was just reflecting on that today. It's actually a year ago right now. It came out May 1st of last year, and it has been selling really well. Most of the bookstores that I've talked to and that the History Center has talked to have reordered. Definitely, that's always a good sign. The online sales have been good. But anyone I talk to, they always have a positive response, and pretty much what you said, I picked it up and I couldn't put it down. In fact, I had one of my friends about a week and a half ago, I had lunch with him, and he made that very comment. He says, I gave it to my brother, and the guy never put it down all night long, read the whole book.
Now,
and that seems to be the seems to be the norm.
Mm-hmm. Now, how long did it take for you to put all of this great information together into this fantastic book, Minnesota's Golden Age of Wrestling, from Fern Gagne to the Road Warriors?
Oh, boy. You know, that's... I think what you really have to say is it took me a year to put the entire manuscript together.
Mm-hmm.
But the book was in my head for many, many years before that. And I'll tell you what really prompted me to write the book. One thing that I'm very, very much a stickler on, Glenn, is I want history recorded accurately. And when I see stuff that isn't the way it happened or the way it really was, it always bothers me. It doesn't matter whether it's wrestling or any other sport or politics, whatever. Well, with regard to wrestling, over the last 10 years, there have been a slew of books that have come down the pike. And what I noticed was there were a lot of people that weren't fans that were writing them. They just seemed to think, well, I'll just put a book together. And mm-hmm. I pick up these books, and there's so many errors. There's pictures labeled wrong with the wrong names under them, and you know, the facts and the stories are wrong. And my daughter said to me about 5 years ago, she said, you know, Dad, rather than complain about it, why don't you write your own book? Well, that's the easiest part of it right there.
Yeah.
I should write a book.
Mm-hmm.
But it is harder than it seems. It's not, you know, it's not, for many years I wrote stories, articles for magazines. I wrote columns for wrestling magazines. That's fairly simple, but when you want to do a whole book, it does take time working with editing and changing things and verifying the facts, and I really was going to make sure that if it was in the book, it had to be accurate. And so that's really very important to me.
Mm-hmm. It's a great read, too, and you give a real great detailed account, year-by-year rundown of professional wrestling in Minnesota. This is so ambitious, and so it's such an addicting read. You begin back in 1954, and where did you get most of this information, and how much of it was from your actual personal collection?
Everything, well, obviously everything I wrote in the book, Glenn, is, you know, from my memory and from my collection. And the way it really happened. It's kind of funny because I talk with Greg Gagne, I talk with Nick Bockwinkel, I talk with so many of the wrestlers, Baron Von Raschke, Dr. X, through the years, Larry Hennig. And these guys, they don't remember this stuff, and a lot of times what they remember it the way they want to remember it. So sometimes they color their own stories. And they get a kick out of it when I correct them. I'll say, Greg, I'm talking to Greg Gagne, I'll say, Greg, it didn't happen that way. Here's what you guys did. He goes, oh, you drive me nuts. He says, I know you know it. Okay, tell me what I did. You know, and Nick Bockwinkel, he'll do the same thing. He'll tell me, he'll call me up and he'll say, was I ever in Australia? What year was I in Australia? And I'll tell him, you know, because he knows I have the results and the records. I have programs that I collected through the years from all of the 30, 35 different wrestling territories around the United States. And so technically, I could do a book on just about any territory I wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, in fact, I've been kind of putting stuff together on the Texas territory, which would be every bit as fascinating as Minnesota.
Oh, man. Oh, you got that in my head now. I'm going to want it in a few years.
Well, like I said, and you asked me how long it took. It took me a year for the manuscript, but it actually took four years complete working with the Minnesota Historical Society. A lot of that had to do with their editing and their publication dates and when they wanted to put it out, and it got bumped a little bit here and there and ended up going through an editor change because they had some issues there at the History Center with government cutbacks. And I mean, it was really a challenge in that respect, but wow, what a labor of love. I just totally love those people for the great work they did. And you're looking at the book, you know how good the cover looks. What the great design that they did inside, but everything in it is from my collection. The pictures, the cover, everything is from my collection.
Have you ever considered getting together with the Minnesota Historical Society and put on some sort of traveling roadshow of your memorabilia, maybe do like a session where you talk to various people about pro wrestling and introduce some of your artifacts to the people and stuff, and kind of just engage them in a great conversation on the history of Minnesota, kind of, you know, on the piggyback of this book?
Well, we did kind of talk about that a little bit, but nothing really to the degree that you're speaking of, but I would certainly be open to it. I will tell you that the Minnesota History Center had a celebrating Minnesota's 150th anniversary as a state here a couple of years ago, and they had a big display there. One of the things that was in their display was a Vern Gagne plaque and a little bio about Vern Gagne. And I was very quick to point out to them that some of the facts that they were putting, that they had on the Gagne plaque, were wrong. And I teased him. I said, "You didn't call me." So, and that may sound arrogant, and I don't want it to sound like I'm bragging, because I'm not, Glenn.
No, no.
But wrestling was interesting in the kayfabe era, and for fans that don't know what kayfabe was, it was just basically the code of secrecy that all the wrestlers, promoters, and people in the business kept and always portrayed it as a real sport. And they would never tell you that it wasn't real or that the matches were predetermined. Mm-hmm. And they would die by that before they would tell you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be back in, okay, sorry.
And that would be pre-1989, 1990.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it would be back in those days, it would be like the magician revealing all of it, showing you a trick and then telling you how it's done before those shows and all those exposés, because a lot of those years, like you said, the magic of pro wrestling was not having people know about it, and it wasn't the sports entertainment thing that it became. It was a lot of people going in there to see the athletic competition and just go in there and just have a good time.
Well, and the key thing, too, was when you mentioned the athletic competition, one of the things that always will disturb one of the old wrestlers is when someone said what they were doing was fake.
Oh.
And I'll tell you why. If you see these boys today, and I mentioned Dr. X or Greg Gagne or Jim Brunzel. You remember Jim Brunzel.
Jumping Jimmy and Greg, the high flyers.
Jumping Jim Brunzel.
What a dropkick.
Yeah, and there you go. There's a story right there about his dropkick. Jim Brunzel is 62 years old right now. And he has had both knees replaced, a shoulder replacement, a hip replacement. And when he had the shoulder replacement, I asked him, this was last year, I saw him in May of last year, and then I just recently talked to him last month. But I said, "Jim, how do you have a shoulder replacement?" You know what he said to me, Glenn?
Hmm.
He said, "You remember all those great drop kicks that I gave that were fake?" Okay, he uses the word fake and emphasizes it.
Mm-hmm.
He says, "Landing on my shoulder 300 nights a year on the mat to give that drop kick. And look what I'm dealing with." And you see these guys, and all of them have had fused ankles and the hip replacements and knee replacements and things like this. And that's all because they gave their bodies to entertain people. What they did was predetermined as far as result goes. But every single one of those guys were extremely athletic in what they did to portray it and make it appear real.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you always have to give them credit for.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, when did your love affair with professional wrestling begin? I mean, you're such a great fan, but when did it all begin for you as far as what drew you into the world of wrestling?
Well, you know, that's probably kind of, you know, the History Center, when we were looking at the introduction in the book, they wanted me to go a little bit more in depth. But long story short, when I was 8 years old, my parents were going through a very nasty time, very nasty divorce. I was the oldest of six kids at the time. There was a lot of fighting in the house. And one night, I just wanted to get away from there yelling and screaming at one another, and I turned on television. And there was All-Star Wrestling, and this would have been back in 1959. Now, I had been to wrestling matches before that, but really too young to remember them,
mm-hmm.
You know, really clear. But I turned on television, and here was Tiny Mills and Stan Crusher Kowalski, two big, long-haired heels, just kicking the crap out of some guy on TV in the match.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought this was cool. And long story short, that's where my escape was from the issues that were happening at home as a little kid, and I turned to wrestling. And I always told people, I said, you know, like a lot of kids, I maybe could have turned to getting into trouble at school or getting into gangs or drugs. I never did that. I got into wrestling and got addicted to that.
Oh,
and it became a way of life.
And thankfully you did, because you've been able to acquire such great knowledge and through your love of the sport and putting into such a fantastic book. Now, we talked about Vern Gagne in the 1950s of wrestling, but professional wrestling didn't start in the 1950s in Minnesota. Whenabouts did pro wrestling start to get going in the state of Minnesota, and how did that come about?
Well, wrestling, what you have to remember is that wrestling was probably around since the turn of the century, the 1900s,
mm-hmm.
they would go from town to town, and a lot of the wrestlers, they were what they would call in those days shooters and hookers. Mm-hmm. They were real wrestlers. A hooker was a guy that could twist you up and snap a finger or an elbow or an ankle or something if you got cute with them. They knew how to protect themselves, and shooters were very close to that. They were able to always protect themselves. And a lot of those early wrestlers from the 1900s, in the 20s, 30s, 40s, they would go around in traveling carnivals. And, you go to the local carnival, and they'd have a strong man there that was taking on all comers. And the one thing that the carnival always wanted to do was they wanted to make sure they had a guy that if someone from the audience or from the customers would come forward that, oh, I'm going to take care of you. Well, they always had to have someone that could protect themselves, and that's where a lot of those early wrestlers got their training. Guys like Eddie Sharkey and so many of them. Red Bastien was another one. He was a carny wrestler. But wrestling was always popular. It just really wasn't until you got after World War II when it started to really take off. And it was because, obviously, the automobile was in full swing. As I mentioned, later in the 40s, we had television. And World War II ended, and people were really into everything America. So you had a Vern Gagne, and you had a Lou Thesz, and you had all these really great wrestlers. And then you throw in the villains when they'd create Germans and Russians and Japanese wrestlers as bad guys. It was America versus whoever, and fans could go to the auditoriums and watch the World War II all over again.
Mm-hmm. And like you said, it really caught fire due to the advent of the television era. And Vern Gagne, of course, was a big part of that Dumont Network era of professional wrestling. He wasn't exactly the world champion, but they threw him in as kind of the U.S. champion from reading your book.
Well, you know, the championship thing in wrestling, one of the things that promoters learned very, very early in the business is that you always had to have something to draw the fan in. And before they came up with really bona fide heels or baby faces, as the good guys were called, they realized that, well, we got to have a champion. Then they've got something to wrestle for. They've got something to fight for. And so there were various champions, but no real claim to the title other than that a promoter introduced them as champion.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in 1948 and 49 when a group of promoters got together around the Midwest and decided that we want to have one bona fide champion that we're all going to recognize. And that's where the National Wrestling Alliance came into existence. And what wrestling promoters would do is pay dues to this organization. They'd recognize one champion, and then the organization, the NWA, would guarantee that they would in turn get the champion on one or two of their cards every year. And when the champion came to town, that was the big one you didn't want to miss.
Mm-hmm.
And the champion's job was to go around and to meet all of the various territories' top champions. Now, when Vern Gagne came along, for whatever reason, the old rumor was that Vern was too small. Well, Vern was 6 foot and probably 200, 220 pounds in his younger days. He had that athletic background. He would have been an excellent representative for champion, but for whatever reason, the NWA didn't see it that way. So as the 50s went on, Vern became more and more disgruntled. Then there was an old thing that happened where the NWA, being a monopoly, there were other factions that wanted to start their own promotions, and Vern was one of them. And he basically started his own alliance in the late 50s, and then officially in 1960 became the very first American Wrestling Alliance. It was Alliance in the beginning, and somewhere between 1960 and 1970, it just changed to American Wrestling Association with no fanfare and no reason given.
Mm-hmm. And once Vern kind of established the AWA, there was a lot of great competition for him, too. We touched base on some of the earlier heels, as they were called, and some of the personalities and, like, the various gimmicks, you know, with the Japanese, the Germans, and the whatever. There was really some great superstars, and one of them that really comes to my mind, and just from seeing him on various television movies and things in the 70s and stuff, was Hardboiled Haggerty. I just have to ask about Hardboiled Haggerty.
Well, now, there is just a character of a guy, and I had a chance to know Hardboiled Haggerty before he passed away in 2002, and what a gentleman he was. But in the ring, there was nobody that could be meaner and more arrogant, more cocky, and he made the perfect, during the 50s, if you looked at 1950s wrestling programs, and if for those that maybe attended some of them, here in the Twin Cities and the Minnesota area, Hardboiled Haggerty and Vern Gagne met many, many times. They just had a great chemistry together. As you said, Vern Gagne, the all-American good guy, and then you put in this bald, he wasn't even bald in those days. That's even funnier when they called him Hardboiled. But you just had this arrogant heel that was always going to knock Gagne's block off, and they just worked so well together. Outside the ring, very good friends. But inside the ring, they had that ability to make fans think that they hated each other.
Oh, and just how many, the stories of just these guys like Hardboiled Haggerty that came up through the, you know, that worked their way to the Midwest, too, in the late 50s into the 60s. Hardboiled Haggerty was a great heel. You got other guys like, Dick the Bruiser and the Crusher, too. Those were some interesting characters as well. I had, when I first started watching wrestling, Crusher was kind of on his last few years of the business, but he was still so charismatic. But, I mean, read the stories about those guys, too, in this book, this fantastic book on Minnesota pro wrestling. These guys were fascinating cats. I mean, and they were able to wrestle long into their later years.
Well, one of the things that was different about the wrestling business in those days, too, is when you looked at a guy like the Crusher or the Bruiser and you saw the builds that they had, those were natural builds. They weren't steroids. They weren't any other drugs like, we really have to look at today with a lot of the modern-day wrestlers. Now, everything is bigger today. But if you looked at the wrestlers of that era, even a lot of them were just normal-looking guys. They were just tough. Tiny Mills. Tiny Mills did not have any type of wrestling build. He didn't have muscles bulging. He was just a big 6'4" guy from Malacca. And, he was a king of the lumberjacks. He was just a tough guy, and he could go in the ring and definitely give that persona. But they always took care of each other in the ring, and that was the important thing.
Mm-hmm.
They may have put on the story that they wanted to hurt each other or end their careers or put them out of wrestling. But the bottom line was, if I did that to you in a match, well, what are we going to do tomorrow night when we're in Wisconsin or, in Milwaukee or Chicago or wherever else we might be wrestling? So, no, they took care of each other, and they made it look so good and so real and believable, and that was the key. They made it look believable.
This concludes part one of my one-on-one interview with pro wrestling historian and author George Shire on the Independent Pro Wrestling in Minnesota show. Coming up on the next edition, we'll talk more about the great history of pro wrestling in the land of 10,000 lakes. Independent Pro Wrestling in Minnesota is recorded live on tape at Pioneer 90.1 FM KSRQ Studios, located in Thief River Falls, Minnesota. Independent Pro Wrestling in Minnesota is a CTC Select Worldwide Production 2011. See you next time. I'm Glenn Broggett.